This episode is brought to you by Essentia. A better you starts with better hydration. Essentia is on a mission to inspire people to do what matters most. Their proprietary ionization process transforms water from any source into ionized alkaline water, providing water that's 99.9% pure with a pH of 9.5 or higher. Essentia overachieving H2O, the number one ionized alkaline water. Shop now.
At KPMG, our people make the difference. Combining the power of people and technology, we uncover brighter insights, innovate bolder solutions, and create better data-driven outcomes. KPMG, make the difference.
When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
Hello and welcome to Radio Astronomy, the podcast from the makers of BBC Sky at Night magazine. You can subscribe to the print edition of the magazine by visiting skyatnightmagazine.com or to our digital edition by visiting iTunes or Google Play.
This episode, we got the chance to speak to former NASA astronaut Mike Massimino about his new book, Moonshot. We discovered his advice for achieving your goals and his memories flying the shuttle and servicing the Hubble Space Telescope.
So Mike Massimino, I'm a former NASA astronaut. I got to fly a couple times on the space shuttle to perform spacewalks to upgrade and repair the Hubble Space Telescope, and left NASA back in 2014, took a position at Columbia University as a mechanical engineering professor. And that's what I'm doing now still. And also do other things too, including writing a book. And this is my newest book here. I don't know if people going to be able to see this, or is it just audio?
Will it be both? So if
it'll be both. Okay. Well, if you're on YouTube, you can see the book in the background, but the new book is Moonshot, and I wrote a memoir. This is a shorter book. So hopefully not too intimidating. I was happy that I looked at it. It didn't look very intimidating when I saw it in its final version just last week. But it has 10 chapters, and each chapter has a theme based on things that I learned in my NASA career and the other thing I learned is that these are the stories that resonated most with audiences that I've spoken to. I've done a great deal of keynote speaking around the world about my experiences. And what I found is what people really were interested in is how did we handle things like pursuing a dream personally, but also teamwork and leadership and dealing with change and trust and the unknown and making mistakes. How do you learn? We know how to make mistakes, but we really need to learn. What I found is I need to learn how to deal with them. So these are 10 things that I learned that are hopefully going to be helpful to people, not only in their professional life, but also in their personal life as well.
Yeah, that's right. Because the each chapter, when you look at the contents, it looks like a sort of a guide to living. You know, like each chapter is like a rule for living almost.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's the idea. You know, it's guidelines. And that's the name of the book is Moonshot. And it's a NASA astronaut's guide to achieving the impossible. So it's meant to be kind of like a guidebook for the things that I learned mainly in my NASA career. There's some about persistence and reaching a goal and so on before trying to get into the astronaut office, but mainly things that I learned in my training and in orbit and working in different places around NASA. It was extraordinary. I learned from so many great people, and some of these things I interpret a certain way. So you'll hear my interpretation, but basically it's the idea, the guideline, the rule, the takeaway, and then the stories behind it. What mistake did I make that enabled me to learn this lesson, and then how did I apply that lesson so I wouldn't be in the same position in the future? And also I try to summarize that. And at the end of each chapter, there's the takeaways that you learn from that you can just read those things at the end to try to summarize and move forward. Each chapter is pretty much independent of the other as well. So you can kind of pick and choose. It's not like there's necessarily a storyline going throughout the book. So just about any one of those, the chapters are intended to be read independently if needed.
Yeah. And it made me sort of think of, when I first came across the book, it made me think about, the right stuff. Mm-hmm. And then you actually talk about how that was an inspiration for you when you were mm-hmm. first dreaming of being an astronaut. Were you thinking about the right stuff when you were writing the book?
The way I refer to the right stuff, I think, in this book was that first of all, it rekindled the dream that I had to become an astronaut. But also it kind of, in some ways gave me the impression of what, that astronauts are really cool and they have camaraderie and so on, that I really, really, was hoping to capture in my life. So there was that part of it. There's also a bit about how, my interpretation of who astronauts were. And sometimes we see that if we're trying to do something with the boss or whoever it is, someone we look up to, we tend to put that person on a pedestal maybe. And that's the way I was with the astronauts when I was a little boy. I mean, they were superheroes and they were very cool guys. There's no doubt about it. Very, very cool. And the shuttle astronauts were very cool men and women. And they were my heroes too. But what I found was that once I got to know some of them by working with them at the Johnson Space Center before I was an astronaut, I felt like I fit in very well, which is kind of an odd thing too, that sometimes, you have this idea of what things are going to be like, but you really don't know. And once you give yourself a chance to find out, you might surprise yourself that you maybe fit in better than you thought. Cause that's something that I found as well.
Yeah, and you also sort of say at the start of the book that, like, you sort of physically speaking, you probably weren't sort of typical astronaut fare, or at least what you'd imagine typical astronaut fare to be.
Yeah, I didn't. I was kind of like this, this tall, skinny kid when I was growing up, and I didn't, and I was afraid of heights, and I still don't like heights. I'm not a thrill seeker. I just am not, and believe it or not, but. So I didn't think I would ever grow up to be like Neil Armstrong. But that was my perception of what it was like. And once I started learning more about astronauts, I found out they were just regular people, especially the NASA folks. They had their good things and bad things. A lot of test pilots are afraid of heights. I couldn't believe it, but I'm not the only person that doesn't like heights that became a pilot or an astronaut. So, I didn't, I think I thought of myself as I could never do it. I was not the typical astronaut. I don't think I am, but I think that's the way people sometimes, think of it, that it's, this lofty group of people that do this. And, they're not necessarily like that. I think that sometimes we can psych ourselves out and think, oh, I can't do that. I'm not talented enough, or I don't have this, I'm not the right person. And you shouldn't limit yourself. You don't really know until you try. And that's one of the themes in the book, is to give it a shot. Give yourself a chance to realize what it is, whatever you want to do, whatever that might be, whether it's doing something in a job or at home or at work or wherever it might be. And don't psych yourself out before you even try.
Yeah, because there could be an element of sort of imposter syndrome sometimes, can't there? Mm-hmm.
Yeah, no, I felt like that all the time and still do in a lot of ways. And I think that's human nature. I think a lot of these things that make us feel like we're not ready, or we're not worthy, or we're not good enough, or whatever it is, I think that's because we're nice people. I mean, arrogant people who think they can do everything, that's what you got to watch out for. I don't know if I could help those people. And those are not the kind of people that we want to choose to be astronauts when we were, or you don't want to have, I mean, someone who's like totally arrogant that thinks they know everything and they're, that doesn't work. It's good to have confidence if you can, but I think a lot of people understand that, or feel just because they're regular people that, they need to work hard and try to fit in and so on. And I think that that's actually a good thing. But I think imposter syndrome probably is a normal thing for most people, but all of these things, I think, keep you humble, but you shouldn't prevent, they shouldn't prevent you from trying something that you think is important to you, because then you get regretful, and that's not a good situation to be in.
eBay Motors is here for the ride. With over 122 million parts, you can make sure your number one ride or die stays running smoothly. Brake kits, LED headlights, bumpers, whatever your baby needs, eBay Motors has it. And with eBay Guaranteed Fit, it's guaranteed to fit your ride the first time, every time. Plus, at these prices, you're burning rubber, not cash. Keep your ride or die alive at ebaymotors.com. Eligible items only, exclusions apply.
Yeah. I mean, one of the bits that I thought was sort of particularly quite funny was the moment where you open the envelope that
yeah.
says that, you know, and then you find out that you've got to pass a swim test, but you don't actually know how to swim.
Yeah. Yeah. After I was selected, I was rejected three times, including a medical disqualification that I had to overturn. And on the fourth try, I was able to get through everything and pass and was accepted. And then I got my information packet. They call you on the phone and ask you, are you still interested in becoming an astronaut? Of course you say yes. And then you open up the information packet that came a few days later in the mail. And the introductory letter was pretty, you know, had in it as a paragraph about swimming, taking a swim test. And at first I was kind of, horrified, but then I was kind of grateful they never asked me if I knew how to swim. I think they just assumed that most people knew how to swim, you know, just like making a cup of tea, you know how to do these certain things in life. You should be able to get in the water and paddle around a bit. But I wasn't a very good swimmer. I didn't like the water very much and never learned to swim well. And now I was going to go through this test. And so I practiced as much as I could. But I wasn't feeling good about it. I thought I could get through it. What I was really worried about, again, you know, looking at my perception of what astronauts were, I knew they were highly qualified people and really smart and high achievers. And here I am, this, you know, pointy head engineering professor coming into this really cool test pilot community, sort of. That's what I kind of envisioned, you know, now going to be hanging out with the right stuff people. And I'm going to be flailing around in the water, you know, having trouble. So I thought maybe I could pass that swim test, but I was afraid of that I might embarrass myself. But anyway, we had our first week of work where together as a class, and it was a lot of briefings in a classroom about standard stuff. And we had a visit from Neil Armstrong, which is anything but standard, in the same week. But at the end of that first week, was all mainly administrative, getting used to what we were going to be doing or hearing about it anyway. And then we were going to begin the second week. And Jeff Ashby, who was in the class, astronaut class before us, a Navy pilot and very experienced guy, great guy. He came in to tell us, well, you know, that's it for the week. It was on a Friday. But before you go home, I want to remind everyone that the swim test that we start off training on Monday, and we're going to start with the swim test. And I was like, how about a math quiz? Can we do something else? Does it have to be the swim test? And I was like, all right, party's over. But then he goes on to say, who are the strong swimmers in this class? And a few people raised their hand. And then he also went on to say, after that, he goes, okay, who are the weak swimmers? I really need to know this. This is more important. And so I raised my hand that I was a weaker swimmer. Or at least in my estimation, I was. And he said, okay, everyone else who didn't raise their hand can go home, but the strong swimmers and the weak swimmers are going to stay after class, and you're going to arrange a time to meet at a pool over the weekend. And the strong swimmers are going to help the weak swimmers with their swimming, because when we go to the pool on Monday, we don't want to leave that pool until everyone passes the test. And so what I found was is that there was a couple lessons there, I think, and that I discuss in the book. You know, one is that if you're good at something, you could set a world record in the pool, for example, but if you left one of your classmates behind, you failed as well. When you're good at something, your job is to try to help people who are struggling. And the other thing is that you don't want to be the person holding back the class. You know, you want to be prepared and not let everybody down, but also how important it was to admit that you needed help, because we were going into this as a team and as a whole class, and we all wanted to pass. And if you, for whatever reason, and sometimes it's you're struggling or there's something going on in your personal life, you haven't been able to put the time in to get ready for the simulation or the exercise or whatever it might be, or you're hurt, you know, sometimes you get hurt and, you know, you're out out in the field somewhere doing something, whatever it is that prevents you from doing what you're supposed to be doing, you need to speak up and get help. And it might be something beyond your control, or it might be just that you don't understand what's happening because it's not something that you generally understand, whatever it is you need to understand, whether it's in your training or a concept or whatever it might be. So it's really important to do that. And I think that that's really hard for people to admit that you need help with something. But if you don't, you're kind of holding back the team. And that's part of the point too, is that when you can give help, you give it. And sometimes that's easier to do, I think. But when you need help, you need to admit it. And I think that can be harder. But I got help from my friends, one of which was Pierce Sellers, who was a naturalized American citizen from England. And he taught me this breaststroke that he learned as a schoolboy, he said, when he was in England. That was a good survival stroke to know. It was really kind of a fun opportunity to learn from some of my classmates. We really had a blast. And it wasn't like they were upset that they had to help the weak people in the class. It wasn't a burden. It was just part of the job. And we all went to that pool on that Monday and all were successful. So that was my first lesson in teamwork and what mattered and how the team success is really what's important and how you contribute to that.
Yeah. And, you know, stories like that and the lessons learned are what's really interesting about the book, that the book isn't Hard to Be an Astronaut, but it's those lessons learned that you could, like, I mean, yeah. Would you sort of think that you can apply most of the lessons that you learned to even to just sort of more ordinary everyday jobs?
Yeah, that's the story. I mean, no matter what it is, if your family's counting on you doing something and you're not able to, you should let them know, I can't do this. Or if you're at work, no matter what your job is, and something's limiting or beyond you, you need to get help, you reach out and get help. And also look around where you can be helpful, because what matters is that the team gets things done. And we can think of the team at home with our families, or we can think of the team who we work with. No matter what your job is, it doesn't matter. You're typically doing things as part of a greater team, trying to get something accomplished. And everyone is important, and you need to help where you can and get help when you need it.
Those are sort of the lessons, some of the lessons that you learned during training and preparation. But actually being in space, actually being, you know, on the shuttle or doing a spacewalk, I mean, that's just a whole other ball game, isn't it? Or is it? I mean, what sort of lessons did you learn actually being an active astronaut?
Well, as far as what we learned in our training, what we used to say about our training in flying is that you train like you fly like you train. So in other words, you know, you want to, whatever it is that you're doing, you're preparing for your job or preparing for whatever you're going to do, and you prepare for it. That's the way you should think of it, as this is the way I'm going to do it when the time comes, you know, that even if you're preparing for your driver's test or whatever, I don't know, whatever it is that you're doing, an exam or whatever, you should prepare, you should train the way you're going to actually do it. And then when you do it, rely on your training. Some of the things I talk about on orbit, for example, being up on orbit's a bit different because now you're separated from people. I mean, you have your crewmates around you, but you're off the planet by definition. You're kind of a long way from home. And there's that connection that we have to our home, to Earth, to wherever we live or where we work or the community we're from. You're not there right now. You're definitely away when you're in space. And a lot of that happens, I think, to a lot of us now too, working from home more since the pandemic, and we're kind of away from people a lot. But we have to remember that people aren't really that far away. And so one of the stories I talk about from being in space, something I learned is that your control center is always with you, even though you might not be in the same room with them. So when we would do our simulations and our training for our flights, the Mission Control Center would practice with us. We had a control team that was training with us to get ready for the flight. And they would be in the Mission Control Center and we would be in the simulator. And those buildings were very close to each other, but we wouldn't see them. We would only communicate over the communications line. They would put an artificial time delay in there. and ratty calm every once in a while and trying to make it seem like we were in space. And so when we got to space, that's the way we communicated with them. And even though I was a world away, I could rely on them. And I had also had that job in the control center as the Capcom talking to the crew. And I knew I had done that after my first flight. I was in the control center doing that job quite often. And I knew how important it was to try to keep that line of communication going. It's kind of like your life tether. You know, we're there for you. It doesn't matter what's going on. You know, I'm here for you guys. And that was you're there for the crew. That was my feeling when I was in the control center. When I was in space, I made a terrible mistake on the Hubble. I stripped a screw trying to do a repair of an instrument. And I remember leaning out and looking at the planet, and we were over the Pacific Ocean, and I thought, I can't even get to a hardware store. I can't even imagine a hardware store that I can get to. I'm in trouble. But I had to tell them what had happened, and they sprang into action and came up with a solution. Now, I didn't know what they were doing. I was just trying to keep myself moving forward and trying to be helpful. And I also talk about 30 seconds of regret. You make a mistake, give yourself 30 seconds of remorse, beat yourself up internally, and then move on. And so I was doing that. I was trying to, all right, I made this mistake. It was terrible. Also, another chapter is it could always get worse. I wasn't going to make anything worse and try to be a good active crew member. And they were working their job, and they came up with a solution that was quite clever, I thought, which was this handrail needed to be removed. And I had stripped the screw at the bottom of it, but it was loose at the top. And so the solution they came up to, after we had tried different tools and other things, to just try to tear it off, tape the bottom of it so we wouldn't get debris. And since it was loose at the top, this handrail, it was a long handrail, I was able to just yank it off. And I didn't think of that, and no one, my crewmates didn't think of that. I needed anyone in the control center, but it was a guy in the front room of the control center, but a person in the back room came up with this idea that, you know, what would he do if he was in his garage? And he said, I would just tear it off. Sometimes brute force is the way to go instead of all these fancy tools that we had. And he called to the Goddard Space Flight Center in Greenbelt, Maryland. And they pulled, it was a Sunday afternoon, but they were at work, of course, to support us. And they pulled an instrument. I had no idea this was going on. I found out about this after. And they pulled an instrument out of the clean room, put it in the same configuration, and yanked on it with a fish scale. And it read 60 pounds of force. And then they radioed that over. And we gave it a try, and it worked. I was able to tear it off. But the message there, is that even though you can't see your support system, you might be separated from them, they're still there. Don't ever forget that your support system is intact. And that might be a family member or a friend or some sort of emotional support person or a doctor to help you when you need help psychologically or medically or wherever that need is, or maybe at work, or someone to help with the kids or with the dog or whatever it might be, or with your a problem with your roof or who knows what it is. We should try to establish this support system. And once we do, don't forget that they're there for you, just like you would be there for them, where you can help. And so reach out to your mission control center. Don't feel like you're in this, going through these struggles alone. I really felt separated from the planet. I felt very alone when I made this mistake, like, who's going to help me now? Mommy, please come help, you know, and that wasn't a possibility, but that team was still there for me. And I had no idea what was going on. I'm up in orbit, and they're running around, communicating around the country to come up with this quick problem. It took about a quick solution to this problem. It took about an hour to an hour and a half to figure it out, to come up with that solution, but they did it. And they were there for me. So I think, whenever we're struggling, reach out to your mission control center. And also, just as important, if not more so, is be mission control for others. Be that person that other people can go to when they need help. You know, Houston, we have a problem. Call me. Let me know. And be that person. When someone's reaching out for help, make sure that they know that you'll be there for them. And reach out to your control center when you need help.
It does sound, though, that... spacewalks and Hubble servicing, and it just sounds like absolutely grueling, absolutely exhausting. How did you sort of deal with the physical and the mental fatigue, and even just that sort of that overview effect, as astronauts call it, you know, of seeing Earth and being in this like dreamlike scenario.
Yeah. Well, I you know, for us, it was when you as far as the grueling part of it, I talk about that, you know, that being nervous about doing something, I think, is a good thing because it shows it matters. And then it shows if something's not important to you, you're not going to be nervous about it. But if you're nervous about it, it shows that you actually care, which I think is a good thing. But there is a point where you have to actually execute that plan when the day comes, whatever that is, the day of the presentation or of the big event or the big cleanup or whatever it is that you're doing that you've been getting ready for. And at that point, it's better not, you know, you never want to be, you can try, being scared isn't good because that can kind of prevent us from doing what we need to do. So what I found to try to get over being scared or nervous about things once the time came is to try to remember to trust your gear, that you have the right tools to help you, trust your training, that when you're given an assignment, your name isn't picked out of a hat. You're ready for it, even though you might not think so. You wouldn't be given that job if you weren't capable. People aren't setting you up for failure typically. You know, so trust that you're trained well, you're able to do whatever it is that you're being asked to do, and trust your team. You know, life is typically an open book test. If you need help, you can go get it. And then trust yourself. And so that actually, I think, saying, okay, I'm ready for this, I can do this, and we're going to stick to the plan and execute as best we can, that helped me overcome what you talked about with the grueling nature of it or whatever it might be. Just let's execute our plan like we had planned. And if we need help, there's going to be help available for me. It's an open book test. And then the overview effect thing, there's a chapter title in the book called Be Amazed. And for me, you mentioned looking at the planet, it was so beautiful. I felt like I was looking into an absolute paradise, that nothing could be more beautiful than our planet. I felt like I was looking into heaven. And that has stayed with me. And it doesn't necessarily, I mean, I'd love to go back and get another view of it, but what I find is that I don't necessarily need to go back to space to enjoy our planet, or based on that experience. And I try to share that with the readers, that, you know, we're looking at the planet from afar and admiring it when you're up there, and it's absolutely beautiful. I think that is the way that Earth was supposed to be viewed. You see its true beauty. But when you get down to the planet, you can still see that same beauty. You can still see, whether it's in nature, you can, you know, if you're out in a remote area to see mountains or whatever, but also just looking up at the sky and seeing clouds, or in a park, if you live in a city with trees and squirrels running around or dogs being walked around Manhattan where I live, or just the faces of the people on a subway. It's amazing what we have down here, and the buildings and everything we've accomplished, the museums are truly amazing, and our planet is amazing, how it keeps us alive. And it's fragile, we need to take care of it, but I think that every day we should try to be amazed just by what's around us. And I think that seeing the Earth from afar made me realize how beautiful it is, how amazing this place is. And I try to keep that in mind every day, that I'm walking around the planet here or moving around in some way or whatever it is, looking out a window, of just how lucky we are to be here and what a miracle it is that we are here.
It is difficult sometimes, isn't it? You sort of, when you're annoyed that your bus is 10 minutes late, and then...
Yeah. Yeah, it's a lot tougher. It's a lot tougher living on the planet than off of it. It's a lot easier in space. Things go much more smooth. I mean, you have problems, but you have a lot of people to help you. But yeah, daily life is not so easy. I am very impatient. I live in New York City, and if I've got to stand on a line and people aren't moving quickly, I do get aggravated. But I try to remember what it's like not to have those things too. I mean, in space, we don't have a lot of crowds. We don't have weather. Things we typically talk about on Earth, I try to think about those times where I was in space and didn't have a cool breeze or the rain or these other miraculous things that we only have here on the planet, which includes crowds. I don't mind crowds so much as long as they're moving. I don't like the waiting around. Just saying, when things are late, nah, that just leads to stress, and that's not good. If we could figure a better way to make things run on time, I think that would be good, but it doesn't always work that way. But still, I think taking a step back and trying to appreciate, trying to think of the good things that we have sometimes helps us get through those tougher times. And the other thing that hit me looking at the planet was my concept of where I'm from and what home is changed when I was in space. I think after my second flight more than my first, I think this feeling that where I'm from, when I was a kid, I was from my hometown in Long Island. Franklin Square was the name of the town, and that was my whole world. And then as I grew up and started traveling a little bit more and going to college, I thought of myself as a New Yorker. That's how I kind of thought of home as New York and in the States. And then I thought of myself as an American when I was an astronaut. I was traveling around the world and flying in space with the American flag on my arm. And I was an American. I worked for the United States government. I'm an American. And I'll always be all those things, a kid from Long Island where I grew up and a New Yorker and an American. But now I kind of think of it a little bit differently. When I think of home and where I'm from, I think of Earth. I mean, that's where I'm from. I'm looking at that planet, looking at our planet, going around it so many times, what happened to me was this transformation of that. That's home. Everything I know, everything I've ever known, every person that we ever know, known about or hear about or anybody alive today is there that we know about. Maybe there's life somewhere else. We haven't found each other yet, but at least everything we know about and everybody we know about, everything is in this one place. And it's a home that all of us share, no matter where you're from, who you are, anywhere on the planet, all of us share that same home.
Indeed. I mean, that's what sort of makes that, and anytime you sort of talk about this sort of that, what you've been discussing there is, you always come back to that Carl Sagan speech, you know, about the pale blue dot. Mm-hmm. You just put it so well. It always comes back to that. But it's interesting. Just because it does feel like we're on the sort of precipice of a new era in crewed space flight. I suppose it has already begun. Mm-hmm. But when we think about returning to the moon and potentially returning to Mars, or not returning to Mars, getting to Mars, do you sort of look back on the shuttle era and the lessons that we've learned from that? And how do you feel about sort of private space flight and the future of crewed space flight and what's sort of potentially happening in the next few decades?
I think that the program has changed a lot, and I look back on it when I was a kid. You know, they were working toward the moon. I mean, even the flights that I don't remember, which were before the Apollo flights, the Mercury and Gemini flights, it was about going to the moon, and it was considered this wonderful age in space exploration. And it was the greatest accomplishment ever, I think, was landing people on the moon. And it was even though the Americans, the American taxpayer was primarily involved, it really was seen as an accomplishment for the whole world. It was a human accomplishment. And then we stopped doing that and we moved on to Skylab and then Space Shuttle. And that was the focus. And now even the Space Shuttle was it for 30 years. And now the focus is on space station for astronauts and flying up on a SpaceX vehicle on the Dragon or on the Russian Soyuz. And so it changes. And whatever happens, it's always going to be moving forward. And even though you get enamored with something, it's not going to be there forever. So we're going to eventually move on from this period too. And we're seeing some of it, as you mentioned, going back to the moon and beyond, maybe Mars at some point. I think Mars will be a place that we will send people eventually. But certainly the moon seems to be within our reach now. And both from NASA and SpaceX is launching big rocket ships now that could reach the moon. So with their Starship. So I think things are always changing and always going to be different. I think the major change that I've seen since the shuttle program ended was the emergence of these private companies. And NASA had a lot to do with that. NASA, with the space shuttle, wanted it to be a commercial vehicle. They wanted the space shuttle to eventually be flown by commercial airline pilots to take passengers, civilian passengers, different places. And then they were rewriting the manuals to do that. Back when the shuttle program first started, to make it from a government vehicle to something that would be used by airplane companies, by airlines. airline pilots could fly it. And then they had the first accident, and that ended that whole discussion. That was it. No, we're not ready for that. But NASA looked at this ending of the shuttle program as an opportunity to involve the more of the private companies and to help push the privatization of space, meaning that you can figure out ways to make money. And it's all about to explore more for these private companies to make money, not for NASA to make money. And also NASA maybe to do other things too. So what the push was to turn the problem of getting people to low Earth orbit over to private enterprise. And they had the commercial crew program, and that was going to be SpaceX and Boeing building spaceships and operating and launching the spaceships, and NASA would be using it like a rental car, sort of, even less than that. I mean, it was really putting all of the burden of building. I mean, NASA had requirements and kind of helped, but it was really the operation, the launch, the care of the spacecraft and the crew was going to be the responsibility of a private company. And we had never done that before. And we were very skeptical that was going to be possible. And they were going to be using a lot of new technology, including automation that would do a lot of the jobs that astronauts had done in the past. And so we were kind of worried about all of this and didn't like that idea at first. But then we started building confidence when we saw what they were able to do, and confidence in the automation, because it seemed safer than what we had been accustomed to, and also could reduce your training. And by reducing training, career astronauts don't need to worry as much or train as much to fly the vehicle. They can concentrate on other things like doing spacewalks and experiments and working the robot arm. And we don't have to worry about training all those emergency. 99% of the stuff we train for the space shuttle, for the pilots, for example, to fly it. And most of the stuff I did from like working the robot arm, it was all these failure procedures and modes that we never would encounter. Whereas now with the automation taking care of a lot of this stuff, you cut down your training and you can concentrate on other things. And it also makes it easier for people to fly in space who aren't career astronauts, so more people can go. And then the new technology, like returning the vehicle so you can use it again, to the returning it and then refueling it and going again, this reusability is bringing the cost down. So the access to space has increased dramatically. My students at Columbia have been able to fly experiments in space, and this sort of thing would be unheard of even just a few years ago. So it's opened up opportunities for people, for students, for researchers, for tourism. So when I look back, when we were so worried about these changes coming and it would end the space program, really what it did is it allowed the space program to flourish, I think. And we were really on the brink of greatness. And so now that these private companies are getting more and more established, and it's not just SpaceX and some of the others that we know about, or most people know about, it's also a lot of smaller companies that are getting involved. Students, or I think young people looking to have exciting careers, can look at the space program, not just working for a government or a big government contractor, but also working as an entrepreneur for maybe a smaller private company doing something really cool. Space stations, I think, are going to be commercialized. They already are. We already had a few private astronaut missions to the space station. There's a plan to turn that space station over to a commercial company, and other companies are looking to build their own space stations. As more and more people get access, they're thinking of things that the government would never think of necessarily, of ways to help the economy, to come up with new products that can only be done, only made and manufactured in space. Because now everybody can think, okay, what I do on Earth and the process that we do, maybe that'd be better off in zero gravity. Maybe we have a chance. You couldn't think about that before because it wasn't possible. But now these things are possible, and we're seeing all kinds of interesting things being done, and all kinds of new ideas, and they're doing well economically. And so I don't see any reason why that shouldn't continue and become even stronger in the future. So I think going back to the moon is now within our reach. We haven't been there for 50 years. We've talked about it, but it's never really been a possibility until now. And I think those changes that NASA made 12 years ago or so have led to that possibility. And I think Mars also is a place that's going to take a little bit longer, but eventually we'll be sending people there as well.
Thank you for listening to this episode of the Radio Astronomy Podcast from the makers of BBC Sky at Night magazine. For more of our podcasts, visit our website at skyatnightmagazine.com or head to Acast, iTunes, or Spotify.